The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
Then there was the conversations that I now saw white women having, which were the same as the conversations that black children often have, which is, when I'm in danger, is it safe for me to call the police? And they were told to flag down a bus. And, you know, that just ridiculous response, that laughable response. It's just been interesting since becoming chair of this board, just how many other demographics are now having very similar conversations about the police.
Welcome, listeners. Today, I interviewed Abimbola Johnson, and she is a barrister at Doughty Street Chambers. I absolutely love this conversation. It was rich, it was deep, it was light. We talked about a wealth of things. She is the chair of the Independent Scrutiny and Oversight Board, which is tasked with scrutinising the policing plan to becoming anti-racist. Now, the board was set up in 2021, and this was in response to long-standing concerns about racial disparities, discrimination, and a lack of trust between law enforcement agencies and communities. We talked about Abby's background and her journey to becoming the chair of the board. She also shared her views on the issue of race in the criminal justice system, a very thorny issue, and also the case of Chris Cabba. Now, if you've not heard of this case, it involved a black man who was shot dead by a firearms officer in the UK. And that officer was unsuccessfully tried for murder. Back in October 2024, the jury returned a verdict of not guilty. I found this episode really hopeful. I found it uplifting because our conversation was focused on how do we build that less polarized society? How do we have those more respectful dialogues around the dining room table with friends, with colleagues, with people that we love? How do we have those conversations with those that we may disagree with?
The Hearing.
Welcome to the podcast, Abimbola Johnson. It's lovely to have your company. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Nice to meet you, Yasmin, and thank you for having me on.
Pleasure, absolute pleasure. So you are a barrister at Doughty Street Chambers. You're also the chair of the Independent Scrutiny and Oversight Board, and we'll get into what they actually do and how you're appointed and the work that you're doing as chair. But first question, an easy one, then could I call you Abby, if that's
yes,
okay? Because I think
fine.
You go by Abby as well. So tell us, Abby, how you got into the law and why you decided to become a barrister.
Yeah, I think my story is quite a traditional one, kind of the straightforward being a precocious young person who was quite outspoken. So people all the way through growing up said that maybe I should be a lawyer or specifically an advocate. And I was also quite lucky in terms of the family that I come from. Pretty much everyone in my family has a law degree, even if they aren't practicing. So the legal profession was very normalized for me. And obviously you sort of are what you see. So when my family saw my characteristics, they identified that as something which would align with being a lawyer. And when I looked into it, it was something that really appealed to me. I was naturally drawn towards the law, really enjoyed public speaking at school, went on to read law at university, and then was quite driven by the idea that I would be using my voice to assist others, but also to being part of the legal profession that really deals with the more dynamic situations, being on your feet, using quick thinking as well as legal knowledge to navigate issues and to problem solve and to provide legal strategy. So that's how I ended up becoming a barrister.
Right. And that's interesting. I have a similar background, actually. Most of our guests said, I took a very untraditional path, but mine was very traditional. My dad was a lawyer. So if you see it, you can be it. I had that influence as well. So it was quite a natural progression. My interest was piqued when he used to speak about his cases as well. So quite similar journey. That's interesting. And when did you qualify then? Which year were you called to the bar?
So I was called to the bar, I'm going to share my age now, I was called to the bar in 2011. I'm past the point now of being able to hide behind being a junior. I'm definitely a senior junior now. So 2011.
Yeah. And have you been doing a lot of, because I first came across you when I heard you on Radio 4, Emma Barnett interviewed you about the Chris Cabba case, which we'll get into in a second. But do you do a lot of media sort of appearances, TV, radio, because you came across exceptionally well, I thought. And I've said that to you before we started recording.
Thanks. I mean, that has definitely stepped up. I think since people started speaking a lot more in depth or with more interest around racial disparity, just in general, that's when people started to ask for some opinions from Black professionals. So I got into writing. I wrote some publications, some articles in The Guardian, other publications. And then I did a TV appearance on Channel 4 News where I spoke about some of the racial disparity and racism that you see in policing. And since becoming the chair of the Independent Scrutiny and Oversight Board, when there are matters that pertain to racism and racial disparity and that crossover with policing and the criminal justice system, then, yeah, there does tend to be a bit more media interest. And I do get requests for interviews. And when I feel as though they are properly within the jurisdiction of my areas of practice and focus with the board, then I do tend to take them up.
Yeah. Keeping you on your toes then,
yeah,
doing those sorts of things. Yeah. So the Independent Scrutiny and Oversight Board, the ISOB, my understanding it was set up in 2021, and that was in response to longstanding concerns about racial disparities, discrimination, and really a lack of trust between law enforcement agencies and communities. So
yeah,
how did it come about that, what led you to accept that role as chair?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite an interesting story. So June 2020, obviously there was the murder of George Floyd, and we saw a lot of institutions and companies starting to make public declarations about wanting to do better in relation to anti-Black racism, some of which, in fact, I'd say most of it was quite tokenistic. I think the remainder of which was quite green in terms of people making massive promises and not really understanding just how detailed and quite frankly, uninteresting and unrewarding the work can be, because it's a real uphill battle. And that actually, once you enter the arena of anti-racism work, you are very unlikely to please everyone, because it's really difficult to get an institution to change, isn't it? So around then, the National Police Chiefs Council, which is the collection of all of the 43 police services or forces around England and Wales, came together and had a discussion about what they should do or could do to tackle racism within policing. And because of the statistics in the UK, which show that Black communities, Black men and Black women, are the most likely demographics to receive the worst of policing when it comes to them, how they're treated as victims, to how they're treated as suspects, to how they are treated as families of victims and suspects even, that the outcomes were really poor for them. And as a result, in some Black communities, so for example, in Black Caribbean communities, the levels of trust and confidence in the police are 20% lower than white counterparts. So it was a real crisis for policing. And they came together and determined that what they would do is fund a four-year program, intensive program, where they would try their best to transform policing, to reduce anti-Black racism within policing, and maybe even manage to put down some foundations to completely eradicate it. But something needed to be different, right? Because otherwise it's just the police making big promises. We've seen it before. What would they actually do which would make this stick properly? So one suggestion that came through, which was really pushed through by civil society organisations and also their own Black police associations, was the idea that they should have an independent board, where that board would be tasked with overseeing the police race action plan, with scrutinising it, with making sure that it wasn't a case of the police marking their own homework. So they put out an advert for the chair role. I saw it a few times. I wasn't initially going to apply to it. I was quite cynical about what it would mean. And by coincidence, at the same time, I'd actually written an article for The Guardian about a conversation that I'd had in a WhatsApp group with a few of my friends. And this is a collection of Black, predominantly middle class, professionals who have had various levels of impact or of conversation and so on with the police. And one of the membership of the group, one of my best friends from university actually, she had written in the group the fact that she had just called the police because she had seen outside of her house in Brixton a black couple who were having some sort of an argument, and she was really concerned about the behaviour of the man in the couple towards the woman, that they had gone into the house opposite and that she could hear banging and crashing, and she was really concerned about the welfare of the woman. So she reported to the group, she messaged the group and said, "What do you guys think?" Because her husband, who is also black, his reaction to her calling the police was, "I don't think that was a good idea. You know, it would have been better if maybe you'd let me," i.e. her husband, "go out and resolve it." There was this reluctance around calling the police, not really questioning whether or not what had substantively happened may have warranted the police being called, but a concern that the police would not have de-escalated what had taken place. And there were varying responses from the WhatsApp group. And I just had this moment of thinking, these conversations rarely happen with my white friends. These are the types of conversations that occur predominantly in circles where I'm speaking to my black friends, and sometimes also with other people of colour. And I just felt drawn to writing this article in The Guardian about the fact that it's a real shame that we live in a society where, because of our skin colour, and you know, these are graduates, these are professionals, these are middle class people, people with firm domestic status in the UK and so on. So on all of the other boxes, we should tick the group, the socioeconomic groups of people who should have faith in institutions, because it's the institutions which are supposed to work for us. But because of our shared ethnicity, we all understood why it was that there were these differences of opinion about calling the police. And I just thought, it's just such a shame that this happened. So I wrote an article about it, just sharing that point and saying, this is the area that we need to see transformed within policing. That lack of hesitation to call the police in a time of crisis and issue, that's when you know that policing has truly improved. And after I had written that article, somebody from the WhatsApp group shared the advertisement for the chair of the ISOB role and said that I should apply for it. And because it came through that precise group that I had written about in The Guardian, I just thought, you know what, this is definitely a sign that I should apply for it. And I read through the advert, and actually the qualities of what they were looking for aligned with my professional experience as well as some of my other experiences. And I thought, yeah, I'll put myself forward and I'll go for it. And what I really enjoy about the role is that it's not my duty to deliver the plan. It's not my duty to draft it. It's my duty and my board's duty to scrutinise the police as they do it. If they instead were trying to hand over that role of delivering an anti-racist police service to me and my 5 board members, I never would have applied for it, because it's an impossible task to give to 6 civilians to do that, because we'd have to win over policing. But rather, it was on the basis that policing had been won over, that they had signed up to this, at least in name, and therefore they should put their resourcing and their effort behind it. Whether that's actually happened is is another conversation, but you asked me why I applied, and that's the basis for the application.
Yeah, that's quite a story. There's a real passion there and lived experience as well. And what you said reminds me, you know, I'm of mixed race heritage, and you know, the conversations you probably have to have with your children will be different to what white parents will have to say to their children about, you know, racism and just experiences that we may have that other people may not have. It's just a different conversation. Your awareness is heightened about these issues because it has to be. Because unfortunately, in the society we live in, we have to talk about these issues, don't we?
But what I do also think is really interesting, isn't it, Yasmin, is that was 2020. And when we think about the things which have happened in the UK since then, we've had Sarah Everard, we've had the revelations which have come through from the undercover police inquiry, We've had a lot of the homophobia and ableism that you see within the WhatsApp messages that were shared after the IOPC exposed the Charing Cross group, and further misconduct hearings that we've had from the Met and from other police forces around WhatsApp groups. I think also what it shows is that this wasn't specific to Black communities. So it was quite interesting, I think. So since writing that Guardian article, I think, A, times have changed. So now a lot of my female friends, my white female friends, are now having similar conversations. Well, how do we know that we can call the police? Do you remember that bizarre exchange that took place where women highlighted the fact that, you know, Wayne Cousins put forward the fact that he was a police officer, and that's the reason why he'd been able to manipulate Sarah Everard to going along with him. And so then there was the conversations that I now saw white women having, which were the same as the conversations that Black children often have, which is, when I'm in danger, is it safe for me to call the police? And they were told to flag down a bus. Mm. And, you know, that just ridiculous response, that laughable response. But it's just been interesting since becoming chair of this board, just how many other demographics are now having very similar conversations about the police. And it leads me to one of the points that I have had to make repeatedly, because one of the kind of criticisms of the Race Action Plan is that its focus is specifically on Black communities. The idea being that you take the lead from how you win over the trust of the Black communities, a trust which has been eroded by the police. And then if you can establish those mechanisms, they could be applied to other communities, other groups. And how true that is, because if the police had got a handle on its racism, it would understand better how to deal with its homophobia, its sexism, and so on. So, yeah, it's just been an interesting few years to see that conversation widening.
Yeah, and the Sarah Everard moment, back to that, was, I think, a real wake-up call for a majority of women, white women particularly, because she was so relatable. You know, everybody thought, that could have been me. I would have trusted the police. I would have gone in the car probably, you know. And actually, it was a strange time. It was during COVID, and she was apparently, he said that she was in breach of the rules of COVID. Mm-hmm. So it was a very odd time anyway, wasn't it? But yeah, I think you're right. Conversations were had then that probably we didn't speak about institutions in that way, and lack of trust, definitely. And Abby, what are the board's main priorities then? You did touch on this, but what are the main priorities? And second part of that question is, how do you actually measure success in this role? I think you said before, I don't know if you can eradicate racism completely, because the police are just a microcosm of society at large.
Society,
so, you know, what does success look like, and what are the main priorities for the board?
Yeah, I think that the key feature, or the key aspect which would denote to us as a board that the Race Action Plan is having the impact that it's supposed to, would be, does it feel different to the average person? So the average person when I say the average person, actually, I should say average people, because there's different ways that we sort of, sounds a bit wishy-washy, but I'll explain it. But there's different ways, right, that we navigate the world. So where I live in the kind of Camberwell, Dulwich sort of area. So I'm in Southeast London, and the demographics are really different, effectively, depending on which way you turn out of my house. If you go in one direction, you go towards Dulwich Village, which is this really beautiful, suburban, quiet area with amazing houses. If you go in the other, you go into the hustle and bustle of Camberwell itself, which is hugely diverse, but socioeconomically. If you go in a different direction, you go towards Herne Hill, which is similar to Dulwich, another you go towards Peckham, and so on. So you could be walking within like a 2-square-mile radius and have a completely different experience of the area. But what I mean is, if the Race Action Plan is having the impact that it's supposed to, it shouldn't matter which direction you would leave my house in. And it shouldn't matter what skin colour you have, what gender you are part of, or whatever. You should feel just as safe in any direction. And I mean, not just that you feel safe because of lower levels of crime. That's not really the direct focus of the Race Action Plan. But I mean, what reaction would you have to a police officer approaching you in the street? I would feel differently if I saw a police officer walking the beat in Dulwich Village versus if I saw police officers in their bully vans as they drive down Brixton Road. You know, they have very different connotations around them. So I think there's that question, does it feel different? Do you find that people are reacting to the police in a different way because the police are interacting with them differently? Do they feel more respected? Do they feel more inclined to go to the police when there are problems? Are we seeing less intrusive tactics being used by the police because they are more trusting of the information that they get from the public, because they have better relationships with the public, so they're able to investigate matters in a less heavy-handed way? Are we seeing more diversion away from policing when it comes to solving issues which maybe are, you know, lower level and tend to be the gateways into criminality that you often see, unfortunately, young Black men in particular being over criminalized for? You're seeing more discretion and more of a sort of holistic approach being taken. Those, for me and for my board, those are the markers around it, as well as how do Black police officers and staff feel about the environment that they're working in. We hear a lot from national and local Black police associations that they have severe concerns about the way that they are treated by their colleagues, about the lack of retention and promotion through their careers. So these are ultimately actually really difficult things to achieve, because policing is massive, because the impression that people have of policing and their feelings toward police officers, it's not just informed by direct experiences from the police. It's also informed by how members of their family have been treated, how their friends have been treated, historically how they themselves have been treated as well. So it's really attritional work, but you would hopefully see a trajectory towards those things improving. And once we see that needle turning, that's when we would say that we think that it's having the impact that it needs to. But it's a really difficult piece of work, because policing is absolutely massive. It's a multi-billion pound industry in this country. We call the police, we rely on the police in our society for such a huge range of things, that there's so many moving parts that it's very, very easy to get things wrong. And also, unfortunately, I don't think as an institution, it really is prioritising the work that it needs to truly deliver against the anti-racism aim in policing. So we have seen some good things happening over the last few years, but it's nowhere near where it needs to be, unfortunately. And they've actually just had to extend the programme for one more year. It was announced for 4 years from summer of 2021. So it's extended for another year until spring of next year. It's in its final year now. And we really need to see how that longer term impact is going to take hold to be assured that this is work that's going to be continuously built on.
Yeah. And you're still a practicing barrister as well. How much time does this take, being the chair? Like, what does that look like? How often do you have to meet? Or this is an enormous task.
It's huge. It's huge. And I've had two children in the time that I've been
just showing
there.
Off now.
I'm not saying I'm doing any of it particularly well. Just saying that those are the areas I'm supposed to be delivering
on. Real.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's. It was advertised as 16 hours a month. I can tell you it is not 16 hours a month.
No.
Not least because it's work that I genuinely care about and find really interesting and I want to do really well. So, you know, if there is a community meeting, if there is a police-based meeting, if there is a report that I need to read, if there's a debate that I should watch, if there's an article that I should write, or I'm going to do it if I think it's going to have an impact and if I think it's going to be meaningful. So in reality, I'd say I probably spend about 3 to 4 times as long as that per month working on my chair role, and that my board probably spends, that they definitely meet their hours most months. Sometimes it's quieter than others. But even when you're not working on it, you know, directly, it's changed the way that I perceive a lot of things. You know, if there's an article that comes up and it mentions the police and race, I will read it. Yeah,
you can't switch off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's kind of constant. And it, not just in relation to policing, because I'm curious as to how other institutions are navigating these issues. I'll go to any sort of conference or even like a social party, and if someone mentions that they work in anti-racism work, I'm swapping numbers with them, we're going for coffee, we're discussing strategies. So I'd say I'm probably always on, but it's what I'm very lucky about is, you know, I think we have this as lawyers, don't we, that actually as lawyers we can kind of make our practices a lot more malleable to align with the things that really motivate us. And as a barrister, I've been really lucky to get to a point in my career where I have been able to pivot. So I was, prior to becoming chair of the ISOB, I was predominantly practicing in criminal defence work, which obviously has huge crossover with the ISOB work anyway. But since doing more and more of this work within the kind of anti-racism specialism, I have been more driven to start looking at areas of law which push for solutions, which push for change. One of my frustrations about doing my pure criminal defence work was I was seeing people when it was too late, right? I was seeing the disproportionality of who I was representing in court, that often I was the black face with my black client. And I wanted to think about ways that those things could be changed, think about the patterns that I was seeing and actually what could I do to actually drive some change around it. So although the ISOB work takes up quite a lot of my time per month, what I would say is that I feel as though it's definitely contributing towards giving me a better worldview, towards giving me more insight in the work that I'm doing. And it has also made me really appreciate how hard people, both within policing and external to policing, work to try to change these things, and just how much work needs to go into the smallest of changes for this area. So it's also taught me, I think, actually, to be quite a lot more forgiving than I believe that we can be, particularly those of us who sit on the left side of politics. I think that we can get into spaces where we're very quick to judge and to dismiss people for not delivering, for not meeting the standards that we want people to be held to. But it has actually, it's really shown me just, I've seen a number of people burn themselves out and then being treated quite irreverently by those both within the programme and external to the programme. It's definitely taught me to be a lot more forgiving. I think that the people who show up and the people who really do the work should be given a lot more credit than perhaps we do as a society. That's not to say that we should lower our standards. I think it's very right to say that we should be aspirational when it comes to trying to deliver against goals like anti-racism, but also understanding that the way that you achieve that and the way that you treat people along the way is very, very important too.
That's so interesting, because in my work and what I see is this polarization and people in their own echo chambers, and they don't usually sit on the other side of the table.
Yeah.
They don't see the work that other people do. And that there's then this massive gap.
Yeah, a huge gulf. Just a massive gulf. So, you know, I've got this very interesting position as chair of this board where I go to things like the chief's council meetings. That's when each of the 43 or technically 44 police chiefs across England and Wales, they meet every few months and they spend 2 or 3 days just discussing the various programs that they have in place, but also discussing things like how much funding they have available to deliver on like basic policing goals, what their priorities are going to be over the next few months. And then I also go to meetings where it's, you know, sometimes it's just 6 or 7 people from a local community who are meeting together and they're trying to come up with how they can make things better for their local community. And I'm always astonished, actually, about how those groups have completely different perspectives. And I think sometimes members of those groups have very different motivations, but there is a lot of crossover between what they would want to achieve. And I saw that a few months ago. So, for example, when Mark Rowley announced for the Met that they were no longer going to attend to mental health crises to the extent that they are doing or have been doing at that point. So right care, right person is the phrase that they use there. And I just thought, how interesting is that? Because that is something that a lot of people from the Defund the Police movement have been arguing for and have been saying, that we should be reducing the scope and the remit of the police, that there's been this mission creep, and that we should instead be having medical professionals, people who are experts in de-escalation, in vulnerability. They should be the ones who should attend things like that. And I just thought, just how fascinating is it that those two completely disparate views have actually resulted in this announcement from Mark Rowley from a different motivation.
Speaking the same language, but it depends who says it.
Yeah, and I think that what I would love to do in future is exactly what you said, Yasmin, which is I'm kind of getting to a point now where I feel as though the last few years, I attend a lot of conferences where I see the same faces and we talk to one another about how we should transform society, how we should change policing. But what we're not doing is making ourselves uncomfortable. We talk a lot about difficult conversations and uncomfortable solutions and how we should stretch people's imaginations. But we actually rarely challenge ourselves to enter a room and go and speak to somebody who has a different political motivation or a different principled approach to something and say, what are our areas of commonality? How can we do this in a way that retains our integrity and respect for, you know, what our priorities are? So there's no aspect of that, but what are the common solutions that we can find? And I think that's a skill that as a society we're really lacking in, and we're losing that ability, and it's quite disheartening.
Yeah, but the culture that I don't think allows us to do that with the age of social media and the algorithms and our private WhatsApp groups and the friendship groups. You probably have the same sort of values as your friends, and how often do we cross the divide and speak to other people from a different viewpoint? And if you do, then, you know, will the friendship be maintained, or what are your values? And I'm noticing this more and more as a trainer and a facilitator, you know, getting people in the room, being uncomfortable, challenge, critically thinking through issues, thinking about things differently. I think it's just a sign, it's society at large, isn't it? So how do you do that on a larger scale in terms of getting people in the room?
Yeah, it's really difficult. It's really difficult. And, you know, I think under the previous government as well, that wasn't encouraged, was it? The sort of
culture wars,
the name calling, it was a race to the bottom in terms of quality of conversation and solution finding being at the centre of conversations. So, I mean, I'm very left leaning. I do actually have close friends who sit on the right hand side of politics. One of my best friends works as a special advisor in Number 10 during the Conservative government. And actually, my relationship with her is something that I really cherish, because it is a reminder to me that she votes in a way that I do not agree with. But what I don't question is that her principles, her core principles, are very much in line actually with mine, that she does want to see society improve. And it's been really interesting, because there have been pinch points over the past few years where we have had to have conversations about the way that things are, about what the Conservatives have been doing about migration, about the rise in racism, Islamophobia, and so on, and just like navigating those points with her. It challenges me to find a vocabulary to express those views in a way that is constructive, but also to leave room for her to be able to express those views to me. I'm sure if you speak to her, she'll say no, she still has to self-centre.
As lawyers, yeah, Shouldn't we hear evidence from the other side and points of view? And doesn't that make our arguments stronger if we don't agree with it? But it's troubling if we can't hear that, if we can't respond and hear other points of views. I think it makes our own arguments weaker, because we don't know the counter argument. I think that's the role of a good advocate.
Yeah, definitely. it's really easy, isn't it, just to write someone off and say, oh, they don't agree with me because they're an idiot, or they don't agree with me because ultimately they're just a really intentional, horrible racist or a bigot. And actually, it's very challenging to make yourself leave space for somebody to talk to you about their views that you don't align with. And yeah, I feel as though these last few years, both in terms of like my professional areas of work, but also my personal relationships, have really forced me to grow in those areas and to make space for that sort of work. And that is what I would like to see reflected in the Race Action Programme. I'd like to see that part of the lasting impact of the programme is seeing policing, being able to navigate those conversations, seeing that nuance entering the way that it exhibits its powers, seeing that it's open and flexible to these solutions, and that it's not shutting people out from conversations and from challenges with it. And all of that hopefully would contribute towards a police force that feels more like a police service. And, you know, that vocabulary is always really interesting to me. So when I first became chair of the ISOB, I described, and I still do, often describe policing as a police force. Policing hates being described in that way. They're like, no, we're not a force, we're a service. And I'm just like, that's so interesting. That's how you want to be seen, but that's not how it's felt by people at all.
No, and people do use force.
Exactly.
That is interesting. It has a different connotation.
The hearing. On the outside, you're a lawyer, calm and cool, but inside there's a passion to perform, a drive to be absolutely on your game. You prepare hour after hour, day after day in the pursuit of excellence, relying on superior resources, serious preparation, and total confidence. That's the advantage we give you. Be your best with Thomson Reuters Practical Law.
From the war in Gaza.
There are a huge network of tunnels underneath. It looks like a spider web.
To the front lines in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News Podcast is there. We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Talking about public debate and disagreements, the Chris Cabot case, I wanted to get into that. That sparked significant public debate, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Yeah,
it challenged lots of people in how they thought about policing and what they thought about this case around the issues of race and policing. Firstly, to remind our listeners, and we've got some, we've got American listeners as well, where this podcast goes out. Can you tell us very briefly, Abby, about the Chris Cabot case? What was that about? What happened?
Yeah, so Chris Cabot was a young man who, it transpired later, had some incidents and some crossover with the police for various reasons, who was shot dead, a single shot, by a serving police officer during a stop, during a road stop. His car had flashed for firearms, and as a result, he'd been boxed in by a number of firearms officers. So there were various investigations that took place, and the Independent Office for Police Complaints, the IOPC, took the decision to refer the shooting to the Crown Prosecution Service, and the Crown Prosecution Service charged the officer who shot Chris Cabot, so that's Officer Martin Blake, charged him with murder in September 2023. And about a year later, in September 2024, he was put on trial for the murder of Chris Cabot, and he was acquitted. And so there's been lots of varying debate around what that means for race relations in policing, whether the criminal justice system is the adequate kind of venue for that. Some people have expressed dismay at the fact that Officer Blake was charged with murder. People on kind of both sides have actually said, have said that, interestingly. Some have said that they think it was an overcharge, like from the outset, that it clearly wasn't murder, that he never should have been charged. Others have said that the prosecution put the case too high, that they charged Officer Blake with murder because they knew that a jury would never prosecute him, would never find him guilty. And therefore, it was sort of like a bit of a conspiracy almost to ensure that he was acquitted. And so some people are unhappy with the fact that Martin Blake was charged. And the background to it is that in the UK, we have never convicted a serving police officer of murder, and that the only time that we've had a guilty verdict for an unlawful killing, for a homicide, is very, very recently in relation to the killing of Danielle Atkinson by a police officer. So what I find quite interesting about it is that subsequently we've seen some conversation which has taken place around the fact that there have been details which have been released about Chris Cabber's previous convictions, which in my view and in the judge's view were not relevant to the trial because Officer Blake didn't know that Chris Cabber had those convictions at the point at which he shot him. There's also been an accountability review which has been announced by the Home Secretary at the time in September 2023 by Suella Braverman at the point where Martin Blake was charged, which would be looking into accountability mechanisms and policies and practices of the IAPC and the CPS. Labour has followed through with that because when they were elected, they said that they would do so as part of their manifesto. So that is ongoing at the moment. And so that's had an impact, you know, the fact that this officer was charged with the murder of an unarmed black man, and that one of the first public announcements made by the head of the Metropolitan Police Service was that he wanted there to be an accountability review because his firearms officers had downed tools. So there's concerns around that, around the optics of that, about the meaning of that. And then also there was an officer who wrote a letter to the court when Chris Cabber's family applied for his previous convictions not to be published until the conclusion of the coroner's inquest into his death, which was going to run after the criminal trial. And in that letter, the Metropolitan Police had written that they thought that it was in the public interest for Chris Cabber's previous convictions to become public knowledge because that would reduce the likelihood of there being rioting, basically, as a result of the not guilty verdict, which I think a lot of people from black communities found quite insulting. Firstly, because there hadn't been any violence attached to any of the protests which had taken place in relation to Chris Cabber, but also because the implication of that could be said to be, well, you know, if you have previous convictions, then you don't deserve public outrage if you're potentially unlawfully killed by the police, which is not a fair way to portray, I think, the family's campaign or even really a lot of the discussion that's been happening around the use of firearms by police officers. So it was an interesting case because I think it has sparked some debates, it sparked some decisions and some reviews by the police backed by the government, which maybe it shouldn't have because it's not a normal case. It's very rare to see officers being charged with homicide offences. So it's all what we can see from that is it's already an exceptional outcome that he was even charged in the first place. And I think there's a risk of it being viewed as a way for people to now push for lower levels of accountability in policing where there doesn't need to be because they are already rarely prosecuted for matters like this.
And I remember you mentioned that point in the Radio 4 interview you did. One thing that you said in that interview that really tested me and made me really think about this deeply is that you said it's very easy to push for reforms when the person at issue is an angel, you know. But the real test of our values as a society comes from how we treat those who are seen as less valuable members of society, given that Cabber had, and it was released, a criminal history, previous convictions. He wasn't an angel, I put that in inverted commas, in the eyes of society. He was some may say a wrong'un, you know, again, inverted commas. And actually, do you want to elaborate then? Do you think that that's really the test then?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think about this a lot because of the racial connotations of it, you know, and again, like I think about it constantly when I look at my son. He's 3, he's already quite tall for his age. It sounds like a weird thing to say, but he's quite toned, you know, even though he's 3, but he's already at a point where people think he's older than he is. Mm. I can see that people treat him differently to his peers, that they expect him to act in a different way because they think he's older. They forget that ultimately he's still this 3-year-old little boy. And it's very different to how they treated him when he was this like chubby little baby who was clearly vulnerable and you know, couldn't really speak. And, you know, to continue the analogy, like, he's 3, so he has huge temper tantrums. He'll shout, he'll scream. He's got very good vocabulary. So sometimes he says things which are actually quite mean, but he doesn't really understand what they mean. But the impact that it can have on you is quite shocking, right? Mm. But he is vulnerable. He's 3 years old. And so you have to remember that vulnerability, it doesn't mean likability, and that actually often the most vulnerable people in society are people who are downtrodden, people who've been treated awfully for various reasons, people who lack self-esteem and who are used to people having very low expectations of themselves. So they have low expectations of themselves, people who live on, you know, the borderline of certain things. It's vulnerability can mean that you're quicker to anger. It can mean that you're aggressive in order to protect yourself. It can mean that you are, on the face of it, more dangerous than other people. And when I look at the way that my clients are described, you know, I've lost count of the number of times that I'm representing a teenage boy, and he'll be described in a witness statement as muscular, extremely strong, really tall, and so on. Like all of these aspects that we use the term now that's quite commonplace, I think, adultification, like this.
Yes.
These aspects that really emphasize the intimidating qualities that people are said to have. And all of that justifies the use of a heavy hand.
Well, I learned that term when there was a story about the young black girl who, I think she was on her period at the time.
Yeah.
The police went into her school. This is in the UK, and was very heavy-handed. And I think she had some weed on her or something.
So they said that they could smell weed, they could smell cannabis on her. And as a result of that, she was subjected to a strip search at school. Mm. And from what I can recall, she was meant to be doing a mock exam. And you know the significance of that as well, so that we don't forget it, is this was in one of the years where, because of COVID, a lot of the kids didn't sit their real GCSEs, so their mocks became their real GCSE results. And so actually the impact of that, of interrupting her from being able to sit her mock GCSE, was, as you know, that then became the qualification that she carries around with her for the rest of her life. That then becomes a point of a really traumatic incident with the police, both in terms of what happened in the immediate, but even the public outcry that resulted as a result. So she would have seen that public debate around it. She'd have had to potentially have relived a lot of that trauma around it. And that's unfortunately likely to follow her for the rest of her life. But yeah, that's what I meant when I spoke about vulnerability, that it's really important to bear in mind that it tests us as a society. We've got to let go of this idea that people who are vulnerable are diminutive, that they're likable, that you just want to go over to them and give them a hug. Of course, then it would be very easy as a society to protect them at all times, wouldn't it?
So going back to our conversation just earlier, Abby, sitting on the other side of the table, you know, we know that Martin Blake, the police officer who shot Cabba, said it was based on a genuine belief that there was an immediate threat to life. So I guess most of the listeners will be thinking, okay, if we put ourselves in the police's shoes, how do we balance that, you know, in high-risk situations like the Chris Cabot case, how can a police officer who is often tasked with balancing public safety in their eyes, you know, he thought this was a risk either to him or his colleagues, if we believe that's his genuine belief, with the protection of individual rights? You know, how can we ensure that police are making decisions that protect the community whilst obviously avoiding harm, particularly to those marginalised groups that we've spoken about? How do we strike that balance?
So I think there's a few things to explore there, but I'll deal with them as quickly as I can. So first of all, in the criminal law, the law of self-defence allows for an honest, even if mistaken, belief that somebody is a danger to you. So for the average person, what that could mean is you make a snap judgment, you're unfamiliar with that person's mannerisms and so on, you misread the situation and you cause them harm, but it's proportionate to the risk that you honestly but mistakenly perceived. Now, fine, that's what we have in terms of criminal liability. And that's because the repercussions of being held criminally liable are severe. You could, you know, spend the rest of your life in prison. It's a different discussion, isn't it, when we're talking about what about the professional parameters around the police using force? And I think it's right to hold the police to a higher standard than the average person. So what do you want? We want to have a police force that understands the nuances of human behaviour, that understands that people react to situations differently, that understands that actually, as a police officer, you are more likely to come into contact with individuals who have had previous contact with the police. You are more likely to come into contact with people who are going to have a response linked to trauma when they see officers in uniform. And so they need to really be able to deliver on de-escalation. They need to really be able to deliver on quick thinking. And if we're going to trust them to use force, if we're going to give them the ability to use lethal force legally, we need to know that they are extraordinarily good at using that discretion in a way that protects themselves and others, but the wider public, and that sense of community safety, in the wider sense. And so I think what needs to happen is we need to see police officers who truly understand the communities that they are policing, who truly understand that, for example, as a Nigerian, my voice modulates a lot. I move my hands a lot. I speak really loudly. You know, my family, I've got a white husband. And I always remember the shock on his face when he first came to one of my family parties. He was just kind of sat in the corner in shell shock while we screamed and shouted at each other across the table. But it was just joyful noise to me. You know, there's those differences. Although ironically, I would say when I went to his family, they weren't that different. it's just like the difference in timbre, I guess. But, you know, I think it's really important, especially when you're talking about police officers who will come across people of colour less frequently. Maybe they, you know, I think it can be easy to say that, oh, it's really important in forces like the Met. But you should also think about, well, actually, it's also really important for officers who are in rural forces who will come across people of colour less frequently and therefore may be more likely to jump to conclusions when they come across that one black person who they suspect of criminality. And so at every level, it's really important to have that. So, yeah, they like to call it cultural competence. But I think that should be right at the centre of delivery for good policing. And it's an ongoing project that needs constant working on because society evolves, it changes, the way we communicate changes. And so that needs to be understood properly by them.
We need to get people in the room, in the same room for a start, don't we? Not operating in silos. I mean, I hear what you say as well, and I'm thinking what the other side would say potentially is that in the Chris Cabot case, the situation was very chaotic. So my understanding is there was only 20 seconds between Blake exiting his car and shooting Cabot. So yes, he's highly trained and police officers should be held to a higher standard than members of the public. I agree with you. They are only human as well, I think people would say. And it was a very chaotic situation. But he was acquitted anyway, wasn't he, Blake?
Yeah, he was acquitted using the criminal legal test for self-defense. The civil test for self-defense doesn't have that extra aspect that you're that your belief can be mistaken and unreasonable. In the civil test, it still needs to be reasonable. So the reasonableness of your mistaken belief comes into issue. And that wasn't a live issue in the criminal test, because as long as it's your honest belief, it doesn't matter how unreasonable it is. So it will be quite interesting to see then what will happen in the civil arena. That's one thing I think that people need to be slow to assert, that because Blake was acquitted in the criminal trial, that means that what he did didn't amount to misconduct. That's not necessarily the case. There's still questions, there's still separate issues to be navigated there. And yes, police officers are human, but they are humans that we allow to use force. They are humans who professionally are trusted to use even lethal force. And that's why, even in those very, very dynamic situations, I don't think, even putting myself into an officer's shoes, I don't think it is too much to say that they should be held to that higher standard and that higher level of scrutiny. And I think it protects them as well. I think that if the average member of public knows that any officer who kills a member of public will have to go through a rigorous legal process as a result, including questions in the criminal arena, in the coroner's court, in civil court, through misconduct proceedings, that does, I think, provide the public with reassurance that the officers who are then allowed to carry those firearms or to use that force will do so cautiously and only when absolutely necessary and justifiably. So it works both ways. It's a clear protection, I think, both for the public and for the police to have a rigorous legal system around it.
And this has been so fascinating. Is there anything else, Abby, you'd like to cover as we round off this interview?
Yeah, so I mean, when we spoke before, I was saying how it would be great to speak at the end, you know, after we've had this discussion, to think about what that legacy would look like. You know, we're now in this last year of the Race Action Plan, and my board and I, we meet every month as a board, as well as our smaller meetings between. And what I've said to them in terms of the perspective is, we've got to really consider how we're using our time. It can't be anymore that we're just sitting down and we're tweaking things, that we're trying to get things perfect, that we're adjusting words or grammar. We've got to be thinking about the legacy of the work. We've got to think about whether we challenged the right people, or if we just spoke, or whether we just had what we view as challenging conversations, but in very safe kind of environments amongst ourselves. We need to be more open to speaking to others, to presenting our views, and to listening to views which are difficult for us to hear, and think about those longer term solutions. And that's what we're going to be doing over the course of this year. And hopefully when this program is no longer a standalone program in March of next year, I really hope that we see evidence of that. We see evidence of people being brought into rooms and having responsibility for delivery of this, even if traditionally there are people who wouldn't have been comfortable with the terminology of anti-racism.
Yeah, wonderful, Abby. Thank you. Well, I hope this podcast will spark some conversations, difficult ones, necessary ones, and really important conversations around the dining room tables. So thank you so much, Abby, for your time.
No problem. Thank you, Yasmin.
The hearing.
As ever, listeners, please do contact us with any feedback you have about this podcast episode or any future guests you'd love for us to interview. You can get in touch and email us at thehearing@tr.com.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.